I'm going to start again my welcome and just say welcome to everybody online joining us here for the hybrid conversations at Kubu as part of the Garden and the Hedge, the closing weekend this weekend, which is packed also with activities. I'm just going to give a little plug if you're still in the neighborhood or if you're tuning in. To the barbecue, to the workshops on fermentation and honey winemaking, also to Paul Grandjean, our guest this week, his mud workshop, and many other treats as well, including the exhibition, both outside and indoors, which will still be rolling until Sunday. The Friday hybrid conversations that have been running over the last 3 months are a mixture of in situ and online conversations with artists and participants who have taken part in the Garden and the Hedge. The Garden and the Hedge was a 3 month summer program that opened on the 5th of June, and as I mentioned, closes at the end of August this weekend. And is the first in a series of programs that will be tied to the elements, with this year focusing on earth, next year on water, wind, fire, or metal, and then ether, bringing us up to 2029. I'm delighted to have Paul here with us.
Beautiful.
Paul's work, particularly in relation to elements and soil and mud, I would say is leading the field in some ways in the UK in terms of a practice that has spans 2 to 3 decades of work, both in relation to thinking about digital culture, electronic waste, organic matter, and our relationship in general with technology. I've known Paul in this time, and our paths have crossed on multiple occasions. He has also been an educator at the Cardiff School of Art and Design for almost 20 years, moving from that post last year or this year,
Just finished in
just finished
July,
in July,
fresh.
and holds a PhD in robotic art from the School of Art in Marseille in France.
No, it's from Cardiff.
Oh, it's from
Yeah,
Cardiff.
it's my
Okay.
BA from Marseille.
My BA from Marseille, my mistake.
No problem.
Good details on the CV,
Yeah.
the footnote here. But to start off, I guess that gives you a sort of a broad overview of Paul's work. He has also been representing Wales in the Venice Biennale in 2025, which
2005.
2005.
Yeah.
There you go. Thanks.
Yeah. Not this year.
Not this year.
No.
No. 2005. There you go. It's and it is a long time ago, but I think it also speaks to your standing actually in the field, and also I feel one of the few artists actually from the field of fringe digital media art practices on one side, and sometimes work that has also not necessarily been represented in white cube galleries. I think you're one of the main people I know in the UK that has crossed over
A
that
little bit,
space.
yeah, at times that's true.
Yeah. So I guess that sort of brings us really to sort of how did you get into this field of practice? And you speak about robotic art. What do you mean by robotic
Yeah,
art?
so I start by I got into the practice. I started from making short videos when I was a student and after. And the videos were fun, a bit funny, a bit singy, and I started gradually to introduce inventions, fictional inventions in the videos, and the inventions, the making of the props became more and more involved. And this is when I moved to the UK, and I had more time. Maybe the weather was crap, and I also was able to tap into the culture of the DIY computing from the 80s, mostly with the BBC microcomputer, which was designed by the BBC Broadcasting Corporation as a tool for educating the masses to computer science and computing. And for example, the BBC microcomputer was fitted with a user port. At the back, so it was actually a socket that was inviting the user to some software and hardware hacking from the go. And there was quite a lot of literature published to support this effort. So when I arrived in the UK, the BBC Micro was already obsolete, so you could find it easily in Skips or in flea markets. And I bought a couple, and I bought some books, including How to Get Started in Robotics with BBC Micro, something like this. And that's how I started learning the ropes of robotics, based on this very old machine. And all the principles that are still at use for programming contemporary microcontrollers, it's all about inputs and outputs and digital and analog and whatever happens with your coding to drive all these little interactions. That was the starting point.
It's a lovely loop here because actually Jonathan Drory, who was one of our first speakers in this series, he was actually part of that community in the BBC
Oh
that
yeah.
created those, and also he is on the had acted as a trustee on the Raspberry Pi Foundation for many years as well.
Okay.
So there's this kind of
Yeah,
nice
yeah, yeah,
nod to the opening conversation
yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
and a closing one here. But this performance, I guess, and performativity and working in a live, interactive sort of way is one of the characteristics.
Yeah. But just before we go into that, just you are asking me what I mean about robotic art. So somehow I got quite a straightforward definition. The way I see it is just appropriating the tools of and the tools and the means and the science of robotics for making artworks. That's, the same way you could say a video artist or is appropriating, like, Nam June Paik or something, like, seeing the potential is. So when I started making robotic art, I was going attending quite a lot of robotic conferences and getting in the early 2000s, I was quite knowledgeable about the cutting edge robotics development, and this informed my practice. And so the robotic art is a way of making art using this knowledge and this technology, or exploring how an artist with limited means and limited scientific knowledge can use these tools for making some practice. And also in my case, it's a way to comment on the societal changes or the technological adoption that these technologies bring to our world, really.
Yeah, and I guess the in the broader canon of media art or digital culture, these tunnels, so to speak, of practice and subgenres sit alongside in this last 20 to 30 years with wearables or with working at with the internet or on the browser
Yeah.
or the infrastructure and robotics. Again, I think is still not something that people ne would necessarily claim first and foremost as like I work with robotic arts. Although there's people we know that we can reference with that
Yeah,
in that.
there's still not that many. Depending
Exactly.
like the scene of robotic artists like claiming this term, is still quite small. Okay. Yeah. Same again. My practice has shifted a bit from that
Yes,
for
of
the past
course.
10 years, so I'm not totally in the know of the latest development, but still from what I can observe on festivals or online presence, the robotic is still quite a small part of the electronic art scene. I think because it's quite difficult. It's it has compared to working like more on screen, computers, and interaction and networks, we can have everything based on your laptop pretty much. The robotics deployment is a more complex endeavor. Maybe that's the reason. I don't know. I mean, for me, like, yeah, this is what I like about it, because it's a practice that mixes some very practical mechanical fabrication. You can. And then you go to the electronic design, the electronic fabrication, and then the coding, and then try to put all this in the mix. And then the deployment, which can be either an exhibition or performance.
I guess a field of physical computing also is kind of where some of that has people would maybe identify with.
Yeah, funny. This was one of my early books, like the, can't remember the name of these guys from New York who published the creative physical computing book in back in the 1992 or something else.
I'm also, I don't want to add, I can't remember also their name. It's just gone out of my head. Cassius
You
Reed.
can put in the footnote. It's okay. It's not serious. Can't you?
No, it's not. But let's going, I guess, moving from the kind of the topic of definitions of where art can be placed, this point of performativity, though, in a way, always felt very lively in your work. I mean, I'm also remembering one of the first shows that I saw of yours. There's sort of two distinct memories in the early 2000s, and one is where you're actually on stage just trying to make fire from sticks and stones, and it's extremely funny to see these attempts. And I can't, if I remember correctly, I think you were saying, "This is my 100th time to try this," and
I
it's
did train.
failure to failing, you know. And then the other piece was in Machinista in 2004, which is actually, I think, when we really first properly got to know each
That's true.
other. And you had made these series of, I would call them robots and machines that you were performing with, who you were trying to sort of express sort of this emotion or love with your partner at the time. And it was like, again, these kind of failures. So these points of failure and the tension between human machine interaction, how do you see
Maybe I
this?
will start with the performance with machines. So that comes from, I mean, the performance aspect with machines or not comes from an intention to be connected. You know, that is like when you do a live performance. Before that, I was sending my videotapes to festivals, and normally I wouldn't go to the festival, and you just get this track, you drop the work into a void, and maybe you get the prize, but you don't really know how it's being received, or it doesn't generate any conversations that you are part of anyway, or very little. Whereas when you perform, like you are in front of the audience and you can have a chat afterwards, and all this dimension is something that drew me into the performance scene or the performance format, because I think I really wanted to have a way of communicating and communicating to some extent in a dialogue with the audience, something which I developed further in a different form. And also it's a way to give more life and presence to machines which are fairly simple and limited. So by introducing the concept, fluffing a little bit about the usage, showing the buttons, all this stuff, it bigs them up, and I quite like this aspect of it. And then the failure happens sometimes. I think most of my performances, there was always something that didn't work or I had to fix live. So that is something I really loved. And okay. And where was I? Yeah, that's bigging it up.
And these points of sort of, I guess, adaptability kind of come into that, and curiosity.
And also like the fire is a slightly different kettle of fish, because it's quite, at the time I often described the main headliner for my work was about the co-evolution of humans and machines. So this idea of co-evolution and how we create these tools to support us and facilitate our lives or lifestyles, and that we adopt these technologies which are becoming more and more complex, with us or most of us understanding very little about the infrastructure that runs them, the technologies that are being used, the science behind them. We just use this like very transparent interface that covers a huge black box that we don't really understand the workings of. And this has triggered reflection to go backwards in time. What would I know to recreate if I was dropped in a world with no tech and I had to reinvent something? So I realized like I couldn't really do much at all. I couldn't mine, or I couldn't create a microchip. I couldn't extract fossil fuels. I couldn't even light a fire without matches, which was like somehow the most primal technology I could think of. So I decided to teach myself how to light fire without matches during performances exclusively. I didn't practice in between, and to see how long it would take. And it took about 3 years, I think, before I finally got the flame. I think it was in Zurich the first time. And
There you go.
here we go.
It's where the magic happens.
It's that's right. So, but that was like quite a, in that case, the failure was very much illustrating my point, how far we are from understanding even the most basic tech. So you can extrapolate from that, but it's that was the point I was trying to make. And once I managed a couple of times, I stopped doing that in performance, but now I got the skill, I can still.
Yeah, we can still do it. Good. We know where to lean on in survival moments.
Yes, but shit, it's the fun.
But I guess these works are, in some ways part of this earlier, I would say maybe mid phase, who knows now at this point, but Mud Machine, for example, that's here in at Kubu as part of the Garden and the Hedge, in some ways still holds many of those aspects. There's the interaction, there's do you want to explain the installation and then we can.
Yeah, well, so the installation is quite it's quite simple. So it's made of electronic waste and found timber, and it's quite a large machine. It spans about 4 meters, and there is various moving parts which can be controlled from a control panel. All is made from recycled, found, and reused. I was like, funny, I was doing a bit of budget because I got some funding for coming here. And I had, I think, £100 set aside for materials, but I haven't spent anything. It is 100% made of. There's a wire, I think, that to a mobot for this, but I think apart from that, everything is made from a scrap. So anyway, and the idea is like this machine plays with mud. It stirs mud. It makes mud splatter. It's sort of a meeting point between the electronic waste, the technological debris, and the very organic material. The even more than fire, I think earth, absolutely fundamental to all life on earth. And this is an encounter, a contrasted encounter between the two, designed with very frugal means, I guess that's a.
It also made me think when we were pulling together the program for the Garden and the Hedge, which takes the element of soil as its sort of substrate or base point, was actually if we were to even recreate mud
So yeah.
or soil, like how would you do it? Like, I mean, the years of work, that goes into it that we throw
Millions,
away. Exactly, millions, millions. I mean, I keep saying that this whole program really brought me back into a very grounded kind of, I kept feeling like I was having my hands in soil when I was actually working on the program because sort of brought me to read literature on, the diversity in soil, that in 1 gram there's like 50,000 species, or the kind of the vast kind of losses that we're experiencing at the moment in terms of actually rich soil. This brings us, I guess, to a point where another, over the years, a moment where our works and our interacted was actually we met in Australia, and at that time it was, I think, ICEA, and you were working on using recycled plastics, and we met again then in Bergen at Pixel a couple of years ago at a program that Sarah Grant was curating for the festival at the time, and this was also speaking to I think it was part of the Mud series that.
No, it was more electronic waste. Like it was like the so the Mud Machine is sort of the latest version of machines I normally create in workshops. So this is the first time, like you asked me to make a version for a gallery exhibition. Normally, this would be a machine that is the fruit of a participatory workshop and just is dismantled at the end. So this. Workshops, I call them wreck shops. So, because we are wrecking electronic waste and make a temporary kinetic sculpture from the result. So, the mud machine was the original one, was one of these.
I mean, that's really good to know, actually, because I was aware that this was the first time in the gallery context, but that's actually the connection between those elements.
Yeah, that's why the one in Bergen was the result of the workshop during the festival and was taken down.
And I guess that point, though, of one of the things I also identify very strongly with your work is that you have always been drawing on waste, electronic waste, bringing again, I think of you as one of the first media artists in the UK and that I encountered alongside, I guess, Ben Goulon in France also, who was pointing fingers directly at this issue in terms of the circular, I guess is what we call it now, the circular economy or circular thinking of waste. What brought you again into that sort of space, and where did it feels really, really punctuated now over the last couple of years?
Well, I guess it's an element of resourcefulness, frugality. Probably also an economy of means, because when I started, I really had very little budget to make things happen. And I've always been interested in recycling. And when the practice develops, the notion of limiting the impact of the practice as much as possible, keep using waste is just the way forward, or recycling, reusing. And I'm really trying to apply this a lot. To everything I do. So, but yeah, it started. I know it's something that's sort of built in thing from being brought up in a not wealthy family. I used to hack bicycles together from bits I found in the skip. And so just a continuation of this approach to a DIY, pretty hands-on way of making things.
It always strikes me, though, that some of these practices, actually, contemporary media art practices are rooted in actually colleagues who are from France. And the Repairability Index, for example, which got launched a couple of years ago, you know, France is leading the way in that. And I would say that France actually, in some ways, could perhaps even be one of the foregrounding countries in the Right to Repair movement, which is about, you know, opening it up and seeing what's in the box with the Repairability Index, almost like this food label that is now being up
Nutri-Score.
exactly that's been applied to certain products. I always make the joke that lawnmowers is one of those, and that there must be a lot of lawns being mowed in France. But it's about having parts available. It's about having access to the manuals. It's about the possibility.
It's funny, sorry, it's a bit of a sideline. It fits well with a sort of post-colonial discourse. But I think it was in 2010, I took part in the Maker Faire in Africa. It was in Nairobi, Kenya. And I met their maker who was making these, customizing these very heavy bicycles they have there and fit them with a little dynamo to charge the telephone. And anyway, I stayed in touch with this guy and I sponsored his work. Like every year, I send him a little stipend. And the level of, so he sends me videos what he does in his workshop, mostly fixes motorbikes. And the level of skill and the level of the reparability that is at play down there is just,
Next level.
it's next level. It's an interesting sort of. So here we are in our society is much more trying to deal with all this extra waste that we have on this surplus of things we don't even want to repair because it's cheaper to buy another one. And in I just don't want to generalize. So in the workshop of this guy in Kenya, I will bring like 2 or 3 more years of usability for a motorbike by rebuilding from scratch, like by sort of forging the metal to do the casing for bearing in the wheel, like that they can't source anywhere. And it's just like, will you do this with his forge and his hammers and his grinder? And it's there is a sort of slight dislocation once again, our westernized way of seeing the world compared to the necessity of repair, I think is just a little insight. I feel quite humble when I watch his video, and I think that's an interesting point to make at this stage, maybe just to reflecting and open the perspective a little bit beyond Europe.
Yeah, I think it also intersects nicely with, again, these times when our work lives have crossed over, where I always feel there's like references that we share, you know. It's always a
Yeah.
nice thing when you hang out with a colleague and you're kind of like, you know, almost beat matching or sampling when you have a conversation. But the low tech magazine and website that I think deserves a mention here, and you were also, I guess, one of the people that were always speaking about that too when you would talk about your work and the age of low tech. You know, we were speaking about this book just before we tuned in today. Do again, a French publication. Do you want to
Yeah, well, so this is a book I came across by chance in a library in Paris when I was transiting through the city. Probably around, can't remember, I think it was published in 2012, so it must have been just that year. And so it's written by an engineer called Philippe Biwix, who used to work for the French National Railway Corporation, SNCF. And he used to be in charge or deeply involved in the management of their sourcing resources to build rail tracks. So he's working with mining operations in several African countries, and he's really absolutely well tuned in the availability of resources, the networks and logistics of bringing them to fabrication. And based on his knowledge of resource availability and the finitude of such resources, the non-renewable resources such as the metals and minerals that are being used by all industries, including digital industries. He wrote this book saying that the subtitle of the book is towards technologically sustainable civilization. In his view, the way we are using the resources to sustain our lifestyles in the Western societies is totally unsustainable. And the sort of fallacy of thinking that by using renewable energies, for example, we are going to be able to sustain our current lifestyle and sustain economic growth is a total scam. There is not enough lithium to build as many electric cars as are needed to replace the float of fossil fuel cars, for example. So his low-tech book is a call for degrowth in a way. We need to, in his view, the only way we can have a technologically sustainable civilization is by really degrowing our need, reducing, becoming frugal at all levels. And this is very well argumented throughout the book. And he says you have a very basic example, like the bicycle is the answer to the crisis in transport, not the electric car for this sort of shift. And that he goes into detail all the way down to the way we dye our fabrics, and that we need to probably live in a world of beige and pale blues, and that we can't sustain the chemical industry to get bright reds and these sort of things. So it's quite a sobering read, a real call for action, for frugalizing our society and our ways of consuming, our ways of transportation, our ways of communication, and accepting that the loss in comfort and in convenience that we are going to suffer through this is likely to be compensated by a gain in quality of life through a slower pace, richer social interaction based on exchange of skills and materials, a less economically driven capitalist sort of take on life, a more communal sort of also more sharing, and a far less material based idea of what happiness can be. I think this is
That's the question in the audience. Is this book?
yes.
I think it's very clear what you've just outlined there in a way, and that reversal though, the chat, I think many people see that as where we are a little bit at this moment, and there's many discussions from different quarters on that kind of, like, say, broader question of degrowth. Where, in terms of an artistic practice, where do you sort of see your thinking, I guess, in relation to those conversations at the moment? And we were talking a little bit this morning, and again, it's just useful for people who might be tuning in now or might tune in later to this conversation about points of reference. You were speaking about the Canadian French author, and you were also sharing, I guess, that question And again, I think many people will have asked themselves the question, how do you respond artistically in a maybe valid and or authentic way to some of those questions that you have just raised or this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to have a. I mean, the way now I've been through quite a deconstruction of my art practice over the past few years, and I think this really started. So, like all these pointers, like the rec shops, the working with the fire, working thinking about, the way we this idea of the black box, all this stuff we've spoke about. Led me to get marginally involved with the Extinction Rebellion in 2019, trying to see if my art could plug in to support an activist environmental activism in a small way. I didn't want to glue myself on a highway or anything like this, but try to see how creative practice could benefit somehow some of the actions. So I got involved in two different aspects. One was just joining the art blocker. Part of Extinction Rebellion, which is when have stalls in the middle of a march or in a site that they occupy, and people can come and get wood block printing on their clothes with like different logos and like a B and an XR, some words in a set of colors decided by XR, like blues and yellows and pinks and blacks. So I got involved in this. Again, I was part of the Art Blockers site in Trafalgar Square in 2019, which was really quite interesting. And I thought a very interesting way of engaging with people who pass by, people who are might be more or less connected to the cause, but this is quite a playful way of disseminating a message visually and get people quite excited about having their kit modded. So I thought that was a very effective way, positive to communicate the ideas of XR. And the other way was to try and make a sort of a sonic placard to be held in the marches, which I call the insect buzz. It was a very simple electronic circuit that made the insect vibrate and emit a sound similar to a bee or something. So at the time, when there was a big report on the death of the entomological fauna. Anyway, so it was all these connections. And then COVID came, and some of my efforts of disseminating these placards were diluted, and I moved on. But it made me also realize that maybe the art practice and the activism are not the same thing. And maybe it's not the role of the art to do that. And if it's not the role of the art, do I want to call my practice or whatever I do art? These sort of questions. And then just decide to just throw away the labels and try to find a way of living and sharing without necessarily aiming for a big activist impact, but maybe on a more granular encounters-based level through a creative practice that takes multiple forms to have just interesting exchanges. That's pretty much the pared-down version where I'm at the moment. So this stuff I do here when I go to the primary school, or we did a workshop in a primary school near Kubu on Wednesday, and it was like an interesting moment with like Finnish kids who more or less spoke English. They really enjoy thrashing through the e-waste. It's just nice to see that and to give them the opportunity to do so. And then I don't know what they are going to take from it, if any, but they have a moment of joy. And then we try to connect it with the mud, working outdoors outside their school, making a weird machine that probably they don't quite get what it's trying to do, but it's quite fun to operate. And so I don't know. So it is like the sharing moments and try to find. Sort of find a way by trying things out.
I mean, I think this way is hopeful in some ways, in
Yes,
terms
yeah.
of let's say a valid practice. Not that I need to say that for you or for me or anybody else, but the what I find is quite interesting, particularly maybe because of the period that we grew up in. We still have one foot in a sort of an analog world, meaning pre-internet and pre a sort of pre-smartphone. And then the other foot firmly in those spaces because we grew up with them. We grew up with them not just as maybe teenagers, but our adult worlds were mediated in this way. Our professional contexts were mediated in this way. So we kind of flip between the two,
True.
in a sense, which could be characteristic maybe of our let's say media art period in a way. But this idea then of what a machine can be or what tech is, or understanding that it can look weird. It doesn't have to be this polished, smooth, silky surface of swipe and push, and that it can look like sticks and mud and messiness in a
It
way.
does, that's true. And also, I mean, like the idea of the workshop, or the idea of bringing the kids to break open an old VCR or mobile phone or whatever we had on this, is also to desacralize the sort of smoothness of the finished product, like break the warranty seal and don't give a toss about breaking it, because it's just, you've got license to do that and have fun and try and explore. And if you are interested, I guide them a little bit, try to show them what I am after, so they can isolate the parts and have a different look at. So it's just enabling people to do that, who especially children might never have opened an electronic device before. And just that in itself is of value, I think, even if they don't go forward to contribute to the sculpture. Just opening it is.
And the confidence also, not only in opening it, but also getting your hands a little bit dirty, because I guess going back to that point about degrowth in a way, and the capital and capitalism in a sense creates a level of comfort, and we'll package this so that you have less discomfort in a sense. But the principles, I guess, of frugality or living with a bit less or having to reimagine living structures are actually about bumping up with discomforts, or what is not in this, again, clean, smooth technological interface.
Discomfort and I think also capitalist lifestyles have also driven us into a very tense and stressed sense of time, which we need to break. I think there's, like, in a capitalist society, time is money, and time shouldn't be money. Time should be time. Time should be passing at the pace, subjective pace. I mean, and this is something, like, more and more with my gardening practice as well, I plug into this dimension, and I find it really quite deeply. It has an impact. It is soothing. It is a way to unplug from a stressed timeline and plug into another one that is equally, I mean, it is fulfilling, but it makes away with some elements which I think are really, because we have been taught and driven to make money with our time as grown-ups especially. I think that's probably, there's something there. And also the need to consume is also, you need to work hard to play hard, and play hard means often acquiring services or objects that are expensive and don't last very long and need to be renewed. All this sort of stuff, it creates a sort of, I mean, it's that, I'm just talking generalities, it's well known, but I think the same with this sort of fairly mature point of view I have after all these years of practice and living. I think the de-locking from the capitalist timeline would be one of my main priorities. And it means also adjusting the lifestyle, frugality, less need for money, more needs for, like, finding systems, bartering, growing stuff, traveling less, repairing lots of things, which is really quite fulfilling as well once you get into the night shift, as you know.
Exactly. It
But
slows.
yeah, it
It
does. And actually, I just redo the button, and even just that is a.
Now, continually, the direct manipulation of time that repair brings is always, you can sometimes see it when you do workshops, the light bulb moment that people are experiencing, or the body changing in front
Yeah,
of
there is an
you.
aspect of almost like a meditative practice, depending on the repair task, but especially with stitching, for example, it's you get into a zone.
Gardening, I think, brings us nicely to Garden Lab Whispers, which is
That's
also
right.
shared in the exhibition. And Shout out to Noel West Media Centre and Ruth Hennell and
Thank
all
you.
the people that
Well,
took part in
that's
this,
good.
which emerged out of the Grounding Technologies project that was run as part of Bristol and Bath Creative. And what, 2 years ago, 3 years ago now?
Yeah, it was 2 years ago. Yeah, I think it
Yeah.
was really single soon.
Do you want to speak to that partnership and collaboration and
Well, so in that case, well, that was on your invitation to apply for this grounding tech, and we made a team with the Noel West Media Center in Bristol, which is a well-established media center located in a fairly rundown or from modest means part of the city. And the collaboration was with a local allotment called Springfield and disabled creatives who were thinking of different ways of facilitating access to nature for people with limited mobility. So there was all these different aspects. So we designed a device called the macroscope that enabled someone in a wheelchair to observe and photograph close-ups of nature without having to leave the wheelchair. And we also did a workshop in the allotment working with microbial fuel cells, which is something I might come back to as it's been a real big part of my practice for the past few years, which is a way to generate electricity from bacteria in the soil. So this is a good way for this workshop, for example, was for children, families from the allotment who came as a stuff after school club. And they each made, they collected a wild plant from the garden, put it in a pot, and then we put two electrodes in the pot. And there is a small amount of electricity enough to generate a small audio signal. And people are often have a little wow moment, realizing that this power comes from the microbes. And there's no battery involved or anything. So this is a workshop we did as part of that. But more widely, the idea of the garden lab is to really think of the garden as a place of, I would say, political creation with a sustainable, it's got everything a sustainable and community agenda. It's a post-digital, it's you share knowledge over the fence, you can grow stuff that will help you be frugal, you can run experiments, you got a space to play. It's I find the garden an excellent contemporary art studio or contemporary practice, contemporary creative practice studio. There's so much to learn, and it plugs you straight, like you talked about having your fingers in the soil. In that case, it was my first year. I have an allotment now in Barrie where I live, and I spent most of my winter bringing soil in and mixing the old soil with the manure. And I really literally had my hands in the soil for hours and hours. And I saw the results in the spring and in the early summer. I got beans and potatoes and courgettes. And so it was like, and learning how to grow this stuff, how to deal with the pests and the weeds, all this sort of stuff. Trying to adhere to permaculture principles, talk to the neighbors who might have different ways of cultivating, and all this is, I find it really fulfilling. And once again, in terms of unplugging from the capitalist timeline, it's really super effective.
And also, I think when you also your work speaks to or is in like service with or for the disabled creatives that you are speaking to, actually, I think it also because those that are in that space of advocacy and activism also are actually continually talking about difference in temporalities and changes and
That's very true.
accessibility. So I
Big
think
time.
exactly. The garden then as a site of exploration, of course, is I think so beautiful way to almost close a conversation with the garden and the hedge and 3 months and that as being the laboratory, it taps into, we had Julian Stanton earlier on in the year speaking also from Winchester School of Art around his teleagriculture project. We had Mark, who was Hacteria here tuning in and also bringing, for six weeks working here, crafting one of our first creative technology residencies at Kubu, looking at the soil microscopes, and also his long-standing practices that kind of tap into these fields of knowledge. But your work also has, this is going further really with goldsmiths and with colleagues and collaborators there. Do you want to share a little bit more about where that is and like you say
Happy.
that.
Just last night I had a confirmation of a small funding I got from the British Council and the Black Mountains College in Wales to continue working with Goldsmith on exploring soil health, both for farming applications and for art installations, I would say.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
Wow.
so I'm going
Cambridge.
to collaborate with a very prominent soil scientist called Jack Hannam, who works for she's just got a new job, but anyway, she was the head of the British Soil Science Association for several years, and she is well connected to farming landscape, farming community, and how soil health can be addressed in these terms. And she was interested in creating a sort of citizen science frugal means sort of sensor that could, from just being plugged in the soil, give an audio indication of the health of the soil, inspired from the piece that we made based on the microbial fuel cell work I did that was installed in the Goldsmith Center for Art and Ecology Research Garden.
I don't know, we've credited everybody in all of the ways.
Anyway, so like the yeah the idea is to work with her and with a microbiologist to see how such a sensor can be made, the technology for quite quickly get a reading from soil health with an audio signal. So that would involve reading the life of bacteria, moisture, maybe some other chemical or mineral aspects, which I am going to work with Jack Hannam to identify. And then with the microbiologist, try to work more on the bacterial level and eventually come back with open source tech that can be applied for both farming, well, gardening solutions, but also for creative applications.
Wonderful. Great. And I think again loops back to what's, Mud Machine sits alongside of Finnish artist Timo Lehtonen's work, where he's listening to the soil changes
Oh yeah,
in
that's
the
okay.
moisturizer, the soil, the moisturizer, the it is the
Yeah.
moisturizer of the soil, but the sound is responding in to that. It's not the same as measuring the soil health, of course. I wouldn't want to say that, but the changes and the fluctuations, though, are giving an audio output.
Yeah.
And this is wonderful. And when do you start off that this work?
Should be November.
Okay. And we'll run into next year, I guess, as well.
I mean, it's a small fund. It's just to get the ball rolling, really. But we'll work together for, I don't know, a number of weeks and see where we're at the end. I think if we manage to get positive results, there should be ways to expand.
Okay. And how does this work, I guess, connect to the broader framing of citizen sort of sensing and citizen science, I guess, that has also been going on for
I mean,
quite a while, bubbling around in the ether.
that's true. I mean, there's no, I think something that I haven't been doing very well is disseminating the findings of my practice. So that's something I'm going to address more. And the citizen science aspect, yes, definitely is a way to, once you say, okay, I make this work open source, then you have to make the effort of putting it on GitHub and advertising, promote it
Yes,
in
exactly.
certain networks, which is something that's one of my to-do list for developing the practice further.
I think also the idea that it's an audio actually signal is actually really strong in a sense, because when it's PHP or if it's moisturizer and it's data, but a person has to read, that's sort of maybe where a disconnect could actually happen, because then people are not feeling like maybe qualified or confident, or they have to then look at another layer of information to get another layer of information. But if you can hear it,
I think that's what the scientist was really interested in. So the immediacy of having a little probe that you can just plug in and you get
isn't
sus. Yeah, exactly.
happy. I'm dying. So, as you can see, we've already solved that pretty good.
categorize the audio signal. Okay. Okay, we're very inspired. I think it's gonna rock. Yeah.
It's great. That's great. One of the things that actually I was hanging out with them before I came to Kubu was Nick Gray. He is a sort of I guess works with the Wildlife Trust in Dorset, and he is supports farmers to think about organic practices and transitioning to sort of net zero, I guess, in terms of land practices. And he had mentioned to me that the if you go into the center, the way that they sort of test the diversity of the land and the soil in some ways is if you go into the middle of this the field and you, let's say, put down a probe or a test and you check, and then you go to the hedge and you check what's under the hedge and see the difference between the two of them, which of course was sort of some of the thinking then that informed the garden and the hedge as this sort of points of conversation between each other, which again loops back into initially thinking around cathedral and bazaar in terms of hardware and open source development. How do things get built up? What's at the edge? What's distributed? How does these are metaphors really, I guess, that we're sitting underneath the idea of the garden and the hedge. But what is that relationship to what's on the periphery and what's in the center, and how actually what's often on the borders or on the edges are where this rich diversity of other things are existing. Again, going back in some of the research that took place as part of the Garden and the Hedge, the CAP grants in the 80s, where farmers were, actually encouraged and given money to destroy hedge
Yeah,
growth,
so to yeah.
80%, 60% in
To
some
expand the
cases.
surface of fields.
Exactly, which was also partly, going back to human machine interactions, was to accommodate tractors as well and to have them, easily run through the field, and they didn't have to then have the kind of the bump of the hedge. But, the reversal now is actually
Yeah,
happening.
it's happening. Yes.
Completely reversal, where people are being paid to ensure that they have hedge grows and and traditional kind of aspects of farming that are being brought in. So it's, I think, also quite
Yeah,
interesting.
on this line, there was like a little report I read a few months ago about one of the richest areas of biodiversity in the UK is along the railway lines.
I also
So
heard that too.
it is not that much. I mean, like they do a bit of maintenance, but there's so many miles, there's swathes of it that are left to grow, and there's lots of biodiversity in there. But people can't access it. The
I mean,
trains disrupt some things that don't want to live there, but lots of things. So animals and plants can actually accommodate the traffic of the trains. Just okay.
I think it swings us back because I know we're going to come to kind of a close now, but also just a little sort of story that when we were working in Berlin and we were speaking with the council there about why there can't be wilder patches in the upkeep of kind of like gardens and parks. And they said, well, if we actually left it all wild, people would actually trash it. They think then that this is not actually cultivated. And this really brings me back again to your work in that, we need to see messy machines. We need to retrain the aesthetics of our eyes to understand that just because something looks, not this neat, perfect, seamless interface, swipe, touch, that it that there's not something less sophisticated happening or less diverse or less rich. It's actually often in some cases the kind of the opposite. So I think I love the fact that you are continually encouraging kids to break open and engage with these things, because I think this is, a pedagogical, habitual thing that we need to keep doing to kind of move in the directions that we've been just speaking to.
And you said earlier on talking about this, like there was some sort of a hopeful dimension coming out of this workshop, and it's something I find quite hard as an individual, or I guess somebody living in 2025 with quite a strong awareness about environmental challenges, and is to keep some sort of hope alive. And something that happened also when I was doing my little stint with XR was like I was so exposed to the science of climate breakdown that I actually got quite depressed and had to pull out from this avalanche of disaster facts and find a way which is a bit more closed in, but I can sustain and hopefully share a small amount of joy, which is like what I'm trying to do through practice.
I think that's a lovely way to end. So I'm going to say thanks for joining everyone online.
Thank you very
And
much.
oh, Ruth, hi. Nice to see you. And thanks, Mark. Also want to just give a shout out to everybody who actually had helped and supported setting up Garden and the Hedge and particularly Mud Machine again to
Yeah.
Mark. And see you guys in real life soon. And yeah, thanks for the claps.
All
Ciao.
right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Ciao,
Ciao.
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 Ciao,
bye.
Bye-bye. Cool.